Why did you stop me from killing her? Tell me while you're still alive.
No, I was born with black skin.
You are born with a black skin?
Yes.
Interesting.
Someone must know something.
I wish to learn.
Read a book.
I would rather have a good composition.
Typical. Selfish. You think like a human.
I have enjoyed this conversation in English.
Welcome to Japanese History Hidden in Our Screens. My name is John Comby, and I'm a public historian. This is the show where I put a podcaster through their paces as they discover Japanese history through the lens of popular media and film. And our guest this week is Vincent Kenny of the Hikikomori podcast.
Hello.
Your podcast follows a lot of modern Japanese history and true crime. So how much are you familiar with like medieval and further Japanese history?
I've touched upon the Meiji Restoration quite a lot, just because it seems to be the most seminal moment in Japanese history. I dare say it's still feeling the effects today. But I would say further back than that, probably not a whole lot of familiarity there.
So that's perfect, because what piece of TV or film did I get you to watch this week for the show?
Seven Samurai.
Seven Samurai from 1954 is the classic movie by Kurosawa Akira. It is widely considered one of the greatest, most influential films of all time in modern filmmaking. Film critic and historian Stephen Prince calls it the clearest precursor of the modern Hollywood blockbuster. If a team has to come together from a variety of personalities to achieve a certain goal, it's Seven Samurai.
It's Ocean's 11 with swords and sandals, yeah.
Our question for today's show is, what does Seven Samurai tell us about the era it depicts? And how does it do that? Well, there's only one way to find out. But first, Vincent, what was your impression from watching the movie?
You know, I remember watching this about, you know, 15 years ago, and I hadn't really thought about it much since, despite the fact that I've been doing, you know, film discussion and Japanese history podcasts, which, honestly, I really should have thought about this more. But coming to this with fresh eyes, I was kind of shocked at the amount of class discussion that's evident in the film, mainly because I guess when people talk about Seven Samurai, they're usually talking about it in terms of editing style and, you know, effect on cinematography and, you know, overall film structure. But I hadn't really heard people talk much about the content of the film. And I have to say, it's kind of shocking compared to, say, modern Japanese politics or, you know, the kind of rose-tinted lens that the Japanese tend to look back at with, you know, at samurai history. So yeah, this is it was really confusing, but in a really good way.
We will get to all of that in today's show. And by the way, I will say there is a quiz at the end.
Oh dear.
So pay attention, everyone. Now, not only do we have the wonderful Vincent here with us, but also you'll be hearing my interviews throughout the show with two historians. They are Dr. E. Taylor Atkins of the University of Northern Illinois, and he's an expert in Japanese popular culture. Indeed, his book, A History of Popular Culture in Japan, has been a key resource for more than just one episode of this series. There is also a second edition coming out this autumn, so hashtag not a plug. Our second historian is the super Dr. Alexander Bennett of Kansai University, an expert in Bushido studies and samurai culture. He holds the rank of Kendo Kyoshi 7th Dan and has recently translated the Hagakure, one of the key pieces of traditional samurai literature, into English. So Vincent, are you ready?
After those two plugs, I am definitely not up to that task, but otherwise I am ready, yes.
Then let's look at the history behind Seven Samurai. The movie, thankfully for me, specifically mentions when it takes place.
Yeah.
It takes place in 1586.
Yeah.
To put it into context for our international listeners, Queen Elizabeth I is on the throne of England. The English colony at Roanoke in modern-day North Carolina is struggling as the first attempt to found a permanent English settlement in North America. The Dutch Wars for Independence are going, well, kind of strong, and the reign of Abbas the Great marks the zenith of the power for the Safavid Persia, controlling land from modern-day Turkey to Afghanistan. So you might know the term, it's quite a popular one, but do you know what period of Japanese history we are in?
I want to say it is near the start of the Edo period, right?
You are so close.
Oh dear.
Because the Edo period starts, depending on who you talk to, 20 or 30 years after this film is set. So we are in the very famous Sengoku Jidai.
Oh, of course.
The Sengoku period, which goes roughly from 1467 to 1603 or 1615. It's also sometimes overlaps with what we call the Muromachi period, which is the other big medieval period from the 1300s onwards. Now, Sengoku can be translated into warring states or time of the country at war. Those names are accurate. You've got local lords and warriors. They'd fight against each other, each for regional supremacy. This is also the point where Western countries such as Portugal, Spain, Great Britain, and the Netherlands first interact with Japan. It is ended by the unification of Japan by the three key figures who we'll get to later. But essentially, how it all started was the failure of the central government in Kyoto. The government essentially ceases to function.
I wonder what that feels like.
Yeah, yeah, who knows? Political power across Japan has just spread from one local strongman to another, and it would take almost 100 years for any leader strong enough to reunite Japan. And we are right at the end of this period when the movie starts. A small village overhears that they'll be attacked by a group of 40 roaming bandits after their harvest, and thus they go to town to try and recruit warriors to protect them. What ensues is one of the best stories of all time. So we won't spoil it too much for you if you haven't seen it. But here's a hint. If you haven't seen it, watch it, watch it.
You should probably watch it. Yeah, it holds up really well, yeah.
It's great. It's really great.
Section 1. The events of the Sengoku period.
Now, there are three key figures who are also called the three unifiers of Japan. Vincent, do you know any of their names?
I want to say Nobunaga.
Yes.
The guy who replaced him after he was murdered.
Yes.
And, like, oh gosh, I can't even think of a third.
The first one is Oda Nobunaga, who is the main person who is seen as, like, the first unifier of Japan. He is assassinated by a man called Akechi Mitsuhide in 1582. And he is replaced by Toyotomi Hideyoshi. And the one after him is Tokugawa Ieyasu. It's his family that then reigned throughout the Edo period.
How did I miss Tokugawa?
Which is sometimes called the Tokugawa period.
Yeah.
The really big important thing we have here is who these leaders are and the importance of a leader. We're going to listen to Dr. Alex Bennett talk to us a little bit about honor.
In fact, loyalty in medieval Japan was very much a on and off contract. You would change your allegiance very easily depending on what was at stake. And the onus was very much on the warlords themselves to be people who that would be respected and followed, because it wouldn't take much for, you know, a samurai to become treacherous or just, completely move to another army.
Does that surprise you in any way, Vincent?
If you had asked me that like 15 years ago, I would have been very surprised in my adventures in Japanese history. I have to say, no, that no longer surprises me. The concept of the honorable samurai has long dissipated from my eyes. It is, I think the warrior class in any culture across Earth, I think, could find the exact same parallels.
This is also the time, regardless of honor, it's where we get guns in Japan.
Mm.
And you see guns in the movie. Guns had been a staple of Japanese warfare since the 1560s. There is some research I've come across that says at the end of the 16th century, so around this point, Japan contained more guns than the rest of the world combined.
I did not know that. That's crazy.
Because not only are guns being imported from the Portuguese, they are making their own guns as well. All these big armies that we're talking about at the end of this period are dominated by firearms. Indeed, Oda Nobunaga is one of the main leaders who emphasizes this use of guns.
It's also extraordinary to me that The presence of guns in Japanese history is always sold as the death of honor. You know, the noble samurai can be taken down. And also its presence, you know, it being a threat to the samurai caste system, that they're no longer seen as, you know, these indelible warriors. Now you can have a peasant shoot down a samurai. But yeah, just the concept that there's so many of them as well, and that they're just so plentiful. In my mind, they weren't as prevalent until the 1800s, but yeah, I guess that's just, it's more how history is sold to us later.
Oda Nobunaga is, of course, killed in 1582, so then there is fighting between two generals, Tokugawa and Toyotomi, for supremacy until 1584. Mm-hmm. Toyotomi also has to conquer the rest of Japan. He is the ruler of Japan at the time of the movie, but he wasn't able to claim the big title. He wasn't able to be shogun. He is then known then and now in much of Japanese history as the Kampak, which broadly translates to as advisor or imperial regent. We think of towns and villages at the time of maybe just being playthings of lords. Like, what do you think when you saw like the village?
It feels kind of desolate, right? Even if these people were doing well, they were certainly still at the bottom of social hierarchy. And the scene at the beginning when the villagers are just sitting around in utter despair, realizing that no help is going to come, that, you know, there's no daimyo to send in an army, that like they'll tax them but they certainly won't help them, is I believe that to be entirely accurate and heartbreaking as well.
Because they're still reuniting Japan at this time. Their lord, they might be hundreds of miles away with the majority of the soldiers. Like, this is also quite weird, because up until about 10 years before this movie takes place, this is probably one of the best times to be a peasant or a farmer in Japan.
Fantastic, yeah.
The Sengoku era was almost a perfect time for villages or towns to be semi-independent. If you were a village and your lord is fighting another lord or fighting another guy, and you're not directly in the way of the fighting, you tend to get ignored.
Yeah, yeah.
You're left to your own devices. You get many towns that almost like clump together in self-defense contracts called Iki. So basically large towns such as Sakai, which is known now more as like Osaka's kind of sad smaller cousin.
Mm-hmm. That's a great description.
However, by the time of the movie, the Iki have been subdued by local lords. Many of the ones that are left connected themselves to Toyotomi.
He's got a lot of stuff on, you know, he's probably not answering our texts for that reason.
But he is sending people round.
Okay, so he's more like a bank, yeah.
Yeah, because he does a land survey, and there's a big one in 1583, where they go to measure every single field in Japan.
All I can think of is huge tracts of land.
If you think of the Doomsday Book, someone is actually in control and goes, "I own all of Japan." What does that actually mean?
Mm-hmm.
The village itself is maybe a little... Usually you might have one or two like more well-to-do farmers that are like the center of the village, that more people... If this could be any kind of village. We have a problem for all our trained peasants as well. Because 2 years after the movie takes place, in 1588, something happened called the Sword Hunt.
Okay.
Because if you are in charge, Vincent, what do you not want all the peasants to have?
Weapons. Got to suppress that revolt before it even happens.
Exactly. And also, arguably, stop all the banditry as well.
Yeah, I guess.
Because you can't be a bandit if you don't have a sword. And also, if you're a farmer, also says maybe they're a samurai, now you've got to choose.
Yeah.
Which one do you want to be? People start to be registered as well. Because when you send people around, you go, well, you own this field, who are you? So you then recognize who people are and where they live. So it becomes more difficult to become a bandit, because if you're a bandit, you still need to go and buy things. You need to be in the system.
Mm.
And also it stops people like Toshiro Mifune's character from like being the son of a farmer and then claiming to be a samurai.
Yeah. This kind of shows me that this is more advanced than feudalism. You know, I think a lot of people think of here's feudalism, oh, and then here's the end of feudalism. But this is kind of like feudalism 1.5, you know, this is, yeah, that the kind of registered ordered feudalism.
It's definitely a development, and it's a system, and it, as anything, it will change wherever you are in Japan. All your ronin, or the term for wandering samurai, you have to go to a castle town because you have to be linked to a lord who will give you some kind of money or take up some kind of work. And the population of Japan at this point is roughly 12 to 17 million.
Okay, that's, yeah, that's quite a healthy population.
It's about double that of Tudor England at the same time.
Not to mention the cultural variance from one side of the country to the other is going to be enormous.
Exactly. It's Japan, big place.
Mm. Yeah, about the size of Germany, right?
It's about the same size of Germany. It's a big place. It's a very big place.
Section 2. What is a samurai?
So, a little bit about the main thing that we associate with samurai, honor, from Taylor Atkins.
At what point does honor just become excessive pride? You know, the willingness to get into a fight because somebody looked at you cross-eyed. That's why daimyo had to create rules and laws that would punish both sides in a conflict because they were fighting all the time. And what were they fighting over? You know, imagined disses.
This is the whole honorable samurai.
Yeah, it's toxic masculinity in the 1500s, you know?
So I'm going to give you a very quick potted history of what the samurai are. They appear around the 11th to 12th century. Origins still debated. Generally, they start as a form of local landlord. They start to develop family groups called ie, or like a house, which is different to how we would view like a medieval house in, say, medieval British history, is that the house also includes those who work for the main family. And this role of power and class, it quickly evolves as the court officials go, okay, we'll use you to do stuff. But turns out the trained soldiers don't particularly like being told what to do.
More of that honor system, yeah.
Exactly. So the family, known as the taira, they end up gaining control over the imperial court in the late 12th century. And this culminates in a civil war called the Genpei War in 1185. And from then on, the samurai class essentially rule Japan up until the 1870s.
Mm.
A lot of this time, we think of samurai honor, it's used for myth-making. Stories from this time are basically used to enforce what a good samurai is. And now when we get to the Sengoku era of the movie, the samurai have gone from being loosely controlled groups that like do whatever they want, and now they're directly linked, usually to lords that have good relationships with others. We've used the term daimyo quite a lot. Daimyo can just mean lord, and they're samurai too. We're going to hear a bit about that from Alexander Bennett.
Within the samurai society itself, there were many, many ranks, and there was a very rigid hierarchy. And the expectations put on each of these levels of within the samurai community were often very different. It wasn't only, you know, within the samurai community itself, but within the various regions throughout Japan, the samurai had very different ideas and ideals and ideologies.
I think if I hadn't kind of been into Japanese history, then that certainly might have. It does sound, the perception given of the samurai overseas is definitely that they were just, you know, warriors that either were hired by a lord or roaming around with, you know, babies on their backs looking extremely cool.
Yeah.
The thing that struck me most about that clip as well is going from the Kiwi pronunciation of like samurai to the very austere, you know, samurai pronunciation. That was my favorite bit.
We will hear more from Alex Bennett throughout the show, and he does sound great.
Yeah, very compelling voice.
But also men got left over from this. Maybe they had left a house, so people move around. This is the term ronin, wandering or masterless samurai. These are what all the samurai are in Seven Samurai. They don't have a direct lord. They are for hire. This is towards the end, obviously, of the 16th century, but that work is becoming harder to find. There is less local beefs. This is part in which it's perhaps more difficult to recognize as a Westerner, but the bandits in Seven Samurai, at least the leader of them, is samurai also.
Yeah, he's got the big old the half moon sigil on his helmet.
This is not a fight between roaming bandits and samurai. It is samurai versus samurai.
And I'm sure for samurai who turn bandits, you know, they're taking what they're owed, you know, in terms of they're not getting a stipend anymore. They just, you know, this is what they do. This is all they know. This is all they've ever been trained for. So why not take stuff?
And here is a clip about what more they are trained to do.
When I talk about how samurai really behaved, I talk about the invasions of Korea in the 1590s. These are people that have grown up never knowing anything but war. Hideyoshi gets them the hell off the archipelago and into the peninsula. They're climbing over each other when they get off the boats to kill as many people as they can. They can't carry all the heads back to get, you know, that they chop off so they can get paid. So they chop off ears and noses and bring those back. And I don't know if you've been to Kyoto and seen the ear mound where they piled them up. And they were doing, you know, they brought home as many as they could so they could get paid because they got paid by the kill. That's who you're, you know, you really want to idolize those people because that was the general run of the mill samurai.
You also get these echoes, like it's not just limited as well to feudalism as well. You get these echoes time and time again throughout Japanese history. And it's not just how they treat Korea, of course, but also later China as well. I'm thinking particularly, you know, in the 20th century. Yeah, it is something that just keeps happening.
I think it's hard to underestimate what an entire class of people that for 140 years, their one job is killing people.
Mm. And then when they don't have that available, it spills over.
Very quickly from that point, we're going to go into what everyone enjoys, which is weapons. Because everyone loves the things that kill people.
Mm.
What is the main weapon you think of when you think of samurai?
Katana!
Exactly. Katana also just means sword in Japanese. Later, they become an emblem of status. You carry maybe the traditional two swords. One is longer, one is shorter. That is referred to as daisho, which means literally big and small. And though they excelled as personal weapons, they became more the specialization of samurai like later. Originally, and we're talking 12th century, samurai were trained with the way of the bow and the way of the horse. Those are the two things you're good at. You might have a sword, like as an extra thing, but they were mounted archers. Most of traditional stories, like from that period, battlefields were seen as individual duels, where you basically had samurai taking pot shots at each other. They would ride around on horses, take turns firing at each other to basically prove their honor and their ability.
Mm.
And this is a traditional Japanese style of bow called a yumi. You see it in the movie, it's wielded by Godobe.
God, he shoots it so beautifully as well.
But it wasn't until the Edo period, which is the 17th, 18th century, where sword ownership becomes the identifying part of the class, after, say, the sword hunt. Also at the time, there are spears, which are also called yadi, or naginata, which is a great weapon because it is a spear, but instead it has a curved, like, katana blade on top.
They look very, very cool.
Now we get to something that everyone wants, the ideology of being a samurai.
Is there one ideology?
Well, that's what we're here to get into. One of the main images we have of samurai comes from later samurai writings. One key one is the Hagakure. It is by a man called Yamamoto Josho Sunemoto, and it is the format of him recounting stories to a retainer. We're now, again, from Alex Bennett, about the most famous phrase of the Hagakure.
Bushido to you wa shinu koto to mitsuketari, the way of the warrior is found in dying. That's always cherry-picked. People writing articles and books and what have you. And it's, you know, it's used as the representative sort of phrase from this, actually what is quite a massive body of work. Well, on face value, it's pretty hardcore, you know. The way of the warrior is found in dying. But now, if you read more around it, you know, before and after and what's going on within the text, you can see that, you know, what George was talking about is, yeah, so you've got to live your life as if every moment is your last.
The book also popularizes the term Bushido, or it's one of the first origins we see the word Bushido. It literally means the way of the warrior. And so this book is especially seen by modern audiences as the samurai handbook. The copy I have on my desk literally calls it the Hagakure, the secret wisdom of the samurai.
Okay, easy there, copywriters.
The problem is that it's a handbook for a very specific time, a very specific place, and a very specific individual.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, let's get into the time. So this is about 100 years after our Seven Samurai. This is a time of peace.
Mm-hmm.
This has been a time of peace for 70 to 80 years by the time of this writing.
By going onto a battlefield and slotting a few people, and you can't do that anymore, so you've got to show it in a different way. The time of when Hagakure came out was a very important time and evolution of samurai ideals, when they were looking to redefine the purpose of their existence. And so what Yamamoto Jocho was doing, he was just offering, like any old geezer would do down at the pub, you know, offer you some advice about, you know, what you need to do to sort your shit out and get on with life.
So it's like as historical as, say, I don't know, Plato talking about the lost city of Atlantis.
They were guards and administrators. And the book is a very personal book. This obsession with death, the book is not popular at the time either. Mm-hmm. It is specifically about the domain in which he lived, which is in Kyushu. It's in modern day Saga. A lot of the time, it is a little bit like this.
The good old days, you know, when samurai were real men, as opposed to the young hooligans of today who only talk about sex and money. And hang on a minute. That sounds vaguely familiar.
Make Japan great again.
Exactly. That's what the Hagakure is writing about. Everything changes over time. It's one thing I want to say is, like, there is no one fixed image. There's no one fixed samurai. The context of Yamamoto Tsunetomo, he was obsessed with death a bit.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that was very weirdly popular at the time is something called junshi, which originates in the Sengoku era, so the time of the movie, where if your master was killed in battle or murdered, you committed suicide. You had failed him, so you committed seppuku. However, when you're in the 1700s and there's no wars going on, how can I get honor? Oh, I know. Yeah. I will kill myself when my master dies. This becomes so popular, they have to ban it. Like, the central government has to ban it, not once, but twice. They have to reiterate, no, this is not allowed.
Oh, boy. Okay.
And the main thing is, the writer, he is writing this after this, he's unable to do it when his lord dies. So instead, he does an almost social form of suicide. He becomes a Buddhist monk.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
And so this book is written while he is a Buddhist monk, basically talking to one of the younger retainers.
Gosh, it's all very Freudian in a way.
Yeah, it's very much creating an image.
Of course, the most disturbing way it was used, you know, was in the 20th century, you know, particularly on the recruits in the Imperial Army.
This book and many others kind of samurai books are almost like they're brought out of like the cupboards and they become these very popular military texts. And because it promotes the ideas of honor and loyalty to your clan leader, i.e. the Japanese government. Pocket Hagakures were published and they become very popular amongst deployed Japanese soldiers, especially during what they call the Pacific War, but World War II. It became a huge focus of criticism after the war because of its association, especially with kamikaze pilots, because it's this idea of death. It becomes more acceptable. It becomes almost like a thing to psych yourself up for it.
From a sociological perspective, I suppose it was used in the same way that religion is often used to minimize one's own death or to find some kind of positive benefit to it, just so that you can basically give your soldiers the enough impetus to go out and kill themselves in the name of your country.
The image of what the kamikaze thought of themselves as the samurai of the sky.
As the modern owners of the samurai spirit. As Japanese people, you must embody the same desire to sacrifice your life for your lord, the emperor, and your country, your domain, if you are called to do so, as we would say, to die for king and country. And so Hagakure provided an incredibly useful and emotive sort of textbook, in a way, kind of developing that mentality, or encouraging that mentality, instilling fervor.
I think it's also worth pointing out as well that this is definitely not unique to Japanese history, you know, for king and country. How often has, you know, Britain used just, you know, a news story to whip up national fervor for some kind of political gain as well? So it's universal.
And it's nostalgia. It's bringing something back. It's going, look at this old spirit. You must imagine it now. This is what history can be used for. History is not just the topic of a fun podcast that you're listening to right now and should review and give 5 stars. In terms of the movie, is the Hagakure is a development of something afterwards, and it's a certain perspective of it.
You know, it reminds me a lot of The Godfather, in a way, of mythologizing, putting down this version of a particular social role, and then that kind of creating the social role. Like after The Godfather came out, mafioso tried to adopt the lifestyle of The Godfather for that very reason.
And it becomes a thing that we have these expectations that now when you watch the movie, something like Seven Samurai, that you think is the creator of these expectations. It doesn't. It doesn't do any of these things at all.
Section 3. Class conflict and the life of medieval women.
Yay, my favourite.
I think it's everyone's favourite. Yeah, at least it should be. First of all, defining class is hard.
Yay.
Because there's a more solid system in the Edo period, which is about 50 years on, we're going to look at that. And then this is a class system called the Shinokosho. And you actually mentioned before, Vincent, that you said that these farmers are at the bottom of society. But no. They're actually second. The samurai are on top, but the second layer, according to Confucian ideals, which become popular in Japan around the 16th, 17th century, is that the more you produce for society, the more valuable you are. Mm-hmm. So because you're a farmer, you are growing, you are literally producing things out of almost nothing, you are valuable.
Yeah.
And then the lower two, which are sometimes lumped together, they're called the chonin. These are the merchants who do almost nothing. They don't produce anything. They trade one thing for another. And the artisans, which do stuff with things that people have already made.
Mm-hmm.
So these two are at the bottom. And of course, this system is not perfect. It doesn't include everyone. As we've said, within samurai, there are multiple levels of samurai. This doesn't include people like religious institutions, or a more common term that people now know when talking about class in Japan, which is the eta, or the untouchables, which would be people associated with death, butchers, etc. These are not within it. But this is the class system that starts to establish itself during the period of Seven Samurai. We see like the problems of class interaction. We're going to hear a bit back from Taylor Atkins.
The thing about the samurai with the peasantry in Seven Samurai is you actually get to see how that relationship wasn't natural at first and how it's created. You know, how they begin to have empathy for one another.
And at the time, there is a thing called the separation edict. This is sometimes seen as the establishment. This is just after the movie takes place. It's so that class conflict is always there, like throughout.
Yeah, because they're terrified of the samurai, you know. I also believe that the farmer who chops off his daughter's hair, he does it not just because he's afraid of the bandits taking away his daughter like they did his wife, but also he says he's also terrified of the samurai as well. So he's also hiding her from the samurai.
class is obviously more flexible in a time of constant war. And as we see with Mifune's character, who claims to be one class who isn't.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, you can be born as a peasant, join a school for swordsmanship, and, you know, you can be in the club, but a lot of the, you know, landed samurai are not going to see you as truly part of that club, though.
And of course, there are examples and exceptions. So,
commoners learning to sing no theater, daimyo entertaining kabuki actors, where you were and when you were there, there were lots of things that could at least temporarily weaken it.
The fun bit, but not in the context of the movie, it's samurai relationship time.
Yay!
Well, kind of. It's the famous scene with Okamoto and Shino, they sleep together, and later her father discovers and beats her for losing her virginity, etc. But the samurai are just kind of like, oh, it happens.
I mean, I'm going to say it does grind the movie to a halt in terms of viewing pleasure, not least because of, you know, the slut shaming and so forth. But, you know, it's on the eve of a big battle. You're kind of wanting things to kind of continue. And then there's just this man crying and screaming and looking in shock that his daughter would have sex.
This is probably one of the main bits of the film that is not particularly accurate.
Mm.
Because sex in 16th century Japan is not a huge deal.
Yeah, especially like there are parts of the country where women were, you know, would have sex out of wedlock. There was the night crawling phenomenon that, you know, a lot of Japanese pretend didn't really happen, but was going on until the 20th century.
The self-autonomy of women during this period, Atkins describes it as basically a downward trend towards the beginning of the 20th century.
Yeah.
Probably one of the worst times to be a Japanese woman would have been the early 20th century. At this point, generally, sex, as long as it doesn't produce children, is seen as, like, fine. I don't think there's really any concept of virginity. As you go on and Confucian ethics start becoming more involved, as I said, in the 17th, 18th century, that's where a lot of the more patriarchal parts come in that make women like be deemed as lower.
Yeah.
If you're a high class woman, you have obligation to your family. But if you're or lower down the class structure, the less it matters. This is the same for like marriage. Unless you're a rich guy, like where there's some this big celebration, etc., most marriages would what we call common law marriages today. There's no ceremony. You just end up living together. And who ends up living together, people don't really care. This clues the same thing for maybe like gay relationships at the time. Japan only outlaws homosexuality in the late 19th century.
Yeah, the Meiji government weren't fantastic.
No, really. No. But now we can go to samurai marriage. So, for example, what are your concepts of samurai marriage?
I'm assuming, oh gosh, yeah. Well, it would have to be with other samurai's daughters, I would imagine. It would have to be of the same class system.
The marriage, yes. You are technically only allowed one wife. But the richer you are as a samurai, you are allowed concubines.
Hell yeah, we're going into Mormonism.
Kind of, yeah. They're not deemed the same level as official wives, but their children can inherit. So if Okamoto somehow became a really rich samurai, he could probably keep Shino as a concubine if he wanted to. Her father beating her is probably like, well, that would have technically been his right too, but it's much messier than the film implies, that this is some kind of moral standing that everyone is held to. Occasionally, especially in the later periods, a samurai would marry the daughters of wealthy merchants, and the merchants would forgive their debts, because samurai were not allowed to get involved in doing like business. So they would get in huge amounts of debt.
Yeah, and it led to a lot of tension towards the end of the Tokugawa reign, right, with all the merchants being a lot more financially stable than the samurai.
It became a mess. It might have been looked down upon, but this kind of sexual relationship would be seen as totally normal.
yeah,
at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and at the same time, they kind of want, Kurosawa kind of wants, you know, both to have his cake and eat it, because he definitely does sexualize Shino in a couple ways. And then kind of moralizes about it later. Like, well, okay, we're going to have the first scene of her being, you know, very dressed very lightly, let's say, like, bending over, and then, you know, slut shame her later on in the film. Is it's definitely 1950s mentality there.
Section 4, Seven Samurai on release.
Seven Samurai was made in 1954 by Kurosawa, and some of us feel as like Kurosawa is the iconic Japanese director.
Mm-hmm.
Japanese critics tended to think of him as the most Western Japanese director, even though in his mind, he was always making movies for Japanese people. He always made them in Japanese language.
This is just after a period of the American occupation of Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And Seven Samurai is called something called a jidaigeki in Japanese, which literally means period drama or period play.
Yeah.
So, and many of these were mostly banned during the occupation because the use of samurai in Bushido was used by the military government.
Yeah, and MacArthur was a crazy lunatic Christo fascist as well.
We think of jidaigeki, you might think of them as, like, implied to be more socially conservative. You think of something like Downton Abbey. Mm-hmm. However, for a Japanese audience, it might be a bit different.
Jidaigeki isn't necessarily synonymous with samurai films, but includes samurai films. We're used to push very progressive causes. You would have these heroic samurai who would fight on behalf of the downtrodden, when, you know, we know that the norm was sort of a more antagonistic relationship. That's the thing that's powerful about Seven Samurai, about the Zatoichi series, the Blind Swordsman, is they're fighting for other people who can't fight for themselves, or they're training them to do it. And the boundaries that they detect between them are broken down so that they're all sitting together and eating together.
I think that, like, historically, they were probably the opposite of that ideal. You know, being used to enforce class suppression more than anything else. But certainly as, like, agents of rebellion and change in the media, yeah, it's romantic. I love it.
That's what Seven Samurai does. It doesn't so much romanticize the samurai, but as these individuals who are good samurai.
Yeah.
And I really think that Seven Samurai promotes sort of the ideology of the occupation way better than it does the feudal idea. It gives each of the seven characters distinctive traits. They are all individuals. They are not sort of representations of this thing called Bushido. Now, they're honorable, but you also see that the bandits are also samurai. You're not blinded to the idea that samurai were preying on the common people. In the course of their relationship with each other, each one of these samurai become better people, more empathetic people, less stuck up, if you will, less, you know, with that sort of samurai pride. They see the nobility in these people. They see the fallibility in their own social group. You know, the most amazing scene is the one right before the intermission, where they find this cache of armor and weapons that the farmers have taken from the bodies of samurai. And the samurai are mortally offended by it. And then Kikuchiyo puts all the stuff on, and it turns out, you know, he confesses that he was a farmer's son. And he said, "Why do you criticize these peasants for preying on the samurai? The samurai are preying on them. What do you expect them to do?"
God, the amount of affection in his voice is really contagious there. I find it so interesting as well that Seven Samurai's politics is much more of a representation of some kind of, like, liberalism that was happening in the 50s in Japan. I mean, the first democratically elected government post-World War II was the you know, the Socialist Party, which and there was a big social movement in, like, the 60s and early 70s towards the left that was, you know, it was its demise was kind of manufactured by the American occupation and then the you know, the CIA funding the Democrat Party for several decades, which, you know, is a he really did touch upon my favorite scene in the film, which is Kikuchiyo's tirade on class differences, right? When he's not only lambasting the samurai for their perceived honor as well, but, you know, he goes on saying, like, yeah, these villagers, they're weak, they're sneaky, they'll hide food from you, they have no honor, but you made them like that. And the passion in that performance is staggering. That's, you know, an enormously powerful moment.
Toshiro Mifune, who plays Kikuchiyo, he is one of the biggest stars of post-war Japan, and it's deserved. He is an amazing performer.
That facial hair alone deserves an Oscar.
We have come to the end of Seven Samurai, a movie that historically is complicated, but actually, I'd say surprisingly accurate.
Yeah, yeah. Not only, of course, to the time it's trying to depict, but the time it was made as well.
Yes, it is a movie that tells a story of individuals that could have existed rather than ones that did. And so now, Vincent,
it's quiz time.
Oh, dear God.
For you and the people at home.
Let me just set up a barricade outside the village, shall I?
Yeah, but you've got to let me in. You've got to leave one area for me to come in. And I'm coming in with quiz questions. So, number one, who directed Seven Samurai?
Akira Kurosawa.
Number two, what period does Seven Samurai take place in?
The Sengoku period.
Number three, name two of the three great unifiers of Japan.
Nobunaga Oda and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
And the other one is Toyotomi Hideyoshi.
Never remember it.
No one ever will. What is the term used for wandering samurai?
Ronin.
What is the phrase that the Hagakure is most well known for?
Death is noble as hell, y'all.
I'll give you half a point. It's the way of the warrior is found in dying.
There you go.
How many main levels were there in the Japanese class system? In the Edo class system?
Four. Yeah, pretty much.
Being two different weapons that a samurai of the Sengoku era would use.
The katana and the spear.
Yes, or yari. Yeah, I would have also accepted guns, bows and arrows.
Naginata.
It's anything you want. What was the job of the guy who wrote the Hagakure when he was dictating it?
I guess he would have been a masterless samurai, really. So wouldn't he have been a ronin?
He took social seppuku. He became a monk.
Oh, of course. I forgot that. Yeah, damn.
After the movie is set, what does the leader of Japan have a hunt for?
Swords.
The Kampak sword hunt. And how many wives could a samurai have?
As many as, well, the one main one, and then as many concubines as his charisma could get him, I guess.
Exactly, one. One is the correct answer there. So well done. You have got 8.5 out of 10.
Yay.
How well did you do at home? Post in the comment.
I'm a telepath, so feel free to just think it really hard.
And did you beat Vincent?
Please don't beat Vincent.
How good do you think Seven Samurai was as a historical film? Let's grade it. Let's give it a grade.
Oh, you know, I gotta go for an 8.5 out of 10 then. If I same score as me, really. Yeah, I mean, it obviously does have the effect of, you know, some rose tinted glasses. I would say, you know, a 7 out of 10, but I mean that in a really good way. You know, 7 is high for me.
I will remain impartial.
Thank you for letting me hang myself on my score first.
Exactly. And where can we find you, Vincent, if we want to find more from you?
I do a couple of podcasts. I do Hikikomori Podcast, which is about Japanese historical storytelling, more, you know, modern history than anything else. I also do a podcast about Final Fantasy called Final Fan Service, and also a horror film review podcast called Not Another Film Podcast. All of the details can be found at SequencePod on Twitter.
Wonderful. And I will put all that information as well in the show notes.
Thank you very much.
We will have more information on our website, which is japanhiddenhistorypodcast.com. There you can read some more in-depth information about the things I've talked about this week. And you can start your own research into Japanese history, if you're so inclined. We are also on all relevant social medias. The links will be in the description. But make sure you tune in next week as we break down Yasuke, the story of the Black Samurai and the first foreign samurai.